Thank you. Please be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument of petitioner in Catalina Development versus County of El Paso.
May we report?
No. Wrong case. Yes, sir.
Not the file I brought. In Holy Bank versus Bank.
May it please the court. This is Zach Brady for the argument of petitioner. Petitioner, 5 minutes.
May it please the court, this is a nuisance case about an injunction that forevermore prohibits legal activity on 450 acres of rural land because of a nuisance found on 10 acres of that land that a jury deemed to cause damages in the amount of $7,262.50. My name is Zach Brady. I represent David and Mary Hollybeck in this appeal. I would like to address 3 points this morning. First, the injunction entered by the trial court is overbroad, an abuse of discretion, and should be overturned. Second, I would like to speak briefly to the implications of this court's opinion in the Payne case with regard to question 8 as submitted to the jury in our case. And finally, address the implications of Chapter 251 of the Texas Agriculture Code, the Right to Farm Act. I'll begin by talking about the nuisance. The Hollybecks began their sheep feeding operation in 1986. In 1996, they began an improvement to that operation wherein they converted a 20-acre trap into a 10-acre intense feed yard with alleys and pens and gates. From 1986 to 1996, by the respondents' own pleadings, no nuisance existed. There were feeders in the area, there was water supplied to the sheep. Feed was brought in from outside for the sheep in that 20 acres to eat. The 5 years before 1997, an average of 2,247 sheep were confined in that 20-acre area. However, under the injunction entered by the trial court, that operation, the 1986 to 1996 operation, would not be allowed. In fact, no feeding of any animal within a confined area on the 450 acres would be allowed. Under the case of Lamb versus Kinslow, which is the case
of... Would you concede that an injunction prohibiting the 10-acre intensive feed lot is proper under this verdict and the damages?
Your Honor, I would concede that...
I mean, what are you asking us to do, to remand to the trial court to take another crack at the injunction?
Your Honor, I'm asking for two alternative remedies. First, to dissolve the injunction in its entirety and impose the findings found by the jury because a balancing of the equities was not called for, or in the alternative, under the Right to Farm Act point of error, to find that question 8 deprived the Hollybecks of their defense under that act and to therefore remand to the trial court for a new trial.
What were the Hollybecks, what were they trying on the, in this case? It is not clear to me from the briefing what was being tried. Are you saying that you expanded the operation and from the date you wanted the trial court to submit to the jury, that's the one-year time frame starts from the date that you expanded the operation? Or are you saying that you didn't expand the operation and therefore there was the time it expired back in 1987?
There was an expansion. The 1986 established date of operation is not the relevant date for terms of the statute of repose. The expansion commenced on March 19, 1997.
That was the confining to the 10 acres.
That's correct. Under 251.003, you get a new established date of operation when that expansion commences.
So Hollybeck agrees that he did change his operation substantially after 1986 It's just that it was not the 1986 they should have been looking at. It was the 1997 date.
That's correct.
And he didn't always testify entirely consistently.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is testimony in the record that Mr. Hollybeck testified that his established date of operation was 1986. However, the statute makes it very clear that the granting of a sign of established date of operation after an expansion does not divest an operation of its original established date of operation.
The statute does not make much very clear. I hate to take you to the third part of your argument, but tell us what you make of this provision. On the one hand, you can't bring an action a year after the date the action, the operation begins. And you say that's March 19, 1997.
Correct.
But then there's a proviso if the conditions have existed substantially unchanged since that day. And there's no finding in this record one way or the other on that. What's the evidence?
Let me first address the record, if I could, Your Honor. There's no finding in this record because of the Question 8 problem. Question 8, as submitted by the respondents, asked if the conditions or circumstances constituted the basis of the nuisance had existed unchanged since 1986. Hollybeck's trial counsel objected to that and said, particularly the date on there. The Hollybeck's trial counsel offered an alternative Question 8, which was admittedly not perfect in tracking the language of the statute. I think that the objection was good enough under Payne, and the question was good enough under John Carlo, Texas, to get us home and to preserve
that. What would a perfect question have been? I have the one you submitted here. But if you get the opportunity to do it over again, what would it say?
I hope that I get the opportunity to submit a question which says, have the conditions or circumstances that constitute the basis for the nuisance remained substantially unchanged since March 19, 1997?
In other words, substantially unchanged would relate back to the condition or nuisance is not operation.
That's right.
That's what's wrong with this question.
With which question, Your Honor?
The 8 that you tried to submit.
The 8 that the Hollybeck's offer does not contain the conditions or circumstances proviso. That's correct.
But then the question you think is going to be, did it relate back to March 1997?
What if the answer is no? It didn't, because that was the day the expansion was completed, but in May, still more than a year before the lawsuit was brought, that's when it actually took off. That's when it really started moving in. Then what?
There are two issues to address in answer to your question. The first answer is, if the jury finds the conditions or circumstances and answers that question no, then the right to farm act defense would not be available to Hollybeck. We need to take that question to a jury to find out. That's why we're not asking for a rendition, but merely for a new trial.
So you agree with the respondent's position that if you started if you completed an expansion on January 1st, 1995, but you don't actually start using it enough to create the nuisance until 5 years later, and then suit is brought 2 years after that, you agree with the respondents, well, this act doesn't apply because the problem, the nuisance problem, didn't occur until 5 years after the expansion.
I hesitate to say I agree with the respondents on that point. One thing I would point out at the first is that the effective date is not when that expansion is completed in its entirety, but the date of commencement of the established operation under 251.03. I would also point out
the actual sheep being present and the operation going on.
And that goes to my next point, which is under 251.004, we have to consider the whole proviso, which is the conditions and circumstances that are related to they've existed substantially unchanged. Pardon me, Your Honor. That the conditions or circumstances complained of as constituting the basis for the nuisance. And that's the question, what is the basis for the nuisance action? It's our position that the basis for the nuisance action is the confining of the sheep in that 10-acre feed lot.
Why is the basis the consequences of the action? The sheep and the flies and the smells and all that, why wouldn't that be the action?
Well, the legislature could have said, provided that the ramifications of the operation or that the conditions complained of have existed substantially unchanged, but the legislature didn't say that. The legislature said the conditions or circumstances that are the basis for the nuisance action.
So under that scenario, then, the nuisance itself might not have arisen at the time the action's cut off. And doesn't that present an open court's problem?
I don't believe it does, because this is a statute of repose, and the legislature, through its policy choices in 251.001, has made it clear that this chapter is meant to limit the condition.
But still, wouldn't that pose a potential open courts challenge? This is different from the architect's sort of 10-year statute, where it's just not discovered, but the defective condition may exist, it's just not discovered for 10 years. I mean, here, the injury would not even arise until after the limitations had run. And isn't that a problem under open courts?
I suppose that I would grant that it could be a problem under open courts, but think of the scenario where a person moves next to an established operation, which I grant is not the condition in this case. It's been going on for more than a year, and the conditions or circumstances are unchanged. Under a statute of limitations framework, that person's injury does not accrue until that person moves.
I'm saying, even if we grant you that it's a statute to propose, and I understand there's a dispute about that, but even if we say, okay, it doesn't depend upon accrual, it is a statute to propose, it's still problematic to say that the action can be cut off by repose before the nuisance even arose.
I would grant that there are issues related to open courts in some scenarios one could think about related to this act. I think the legislature, in making its policy choices, considered those scenarios and decided that the preservation of our agricultural operations in this state.
Well, I understand the policy reason behind it, but it's still a good policy reason to violate open courts, which is a judicial decision. So that has not been raised in this case. Is that correct?
That's correct. I don't believe that the idea that this statute violates the open court provision has been briefed extensively enough to be before the court today. But I would certainly acknowledge that there could be an open court problem in some scenarios. I don't believe that's the case here.
Let me ask you about the basis for the nuisance. I have a couple of questions. Basis for the nuisance. I guess you could say that in feedlot operation with sheep will produce smell and flies and problems that will affect neighboring property, but not necessarily so. If this 10-acre deal had been, I don't know, 500 feet away from the residence or had been around the bend from the residence, or had a row of trees in between the residence, it's entirely possible this entire operation could have been conducted without producing a nuisance. There'd be no basis for a nuisance. Isn't to say that I'm raising sheep is the nuisance isn't really the answer. It's the way the sheep are being raised that produces a nuisance, isn't it? So couldn't I argue that, you know, you started the sheep doing, but you did something in the process of raising these sheep that caused the nuisance. Not the sheep themselves, but you weren't cleaning up the manure timely, or you moved the, I don't know, dead pit, I guess, right here. And after a year, it finally filled up with enough carcasses that it started producing a nuisance that wasn't before. I mean, isn't there some flexibility in the statute that it wasn't exactly that you decided you established a feedlot, but the way you're running feedlot that would be the basis of the nuisance?
I believe that there is. I agree with that hypothetical, that there is some flexibility in the statute. I would point out that I think those inquiries are fact inquiries. And while it may be unclear as to whether question 8 should have been March or June of 97, I've said I'd submit March, the Halifax Trial Council submitted June. What is clear is that it shouldn't have been 1986, and that because of that defective question, the jury did not get to grapple with the very fact issues that your hypothetical raises, Your Honor. In the time I have remaining, if I could, I'd like to focus on the injunction briefly.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Miller, that argument from respondent. May it please the court, co-counsel Mr. Jack Lee of the Mason County Bar. We represent the respondents in this case. And I want to touch on the points in reverse order from the petitioner. First, the statutory interpretation question. Second, the sound exercise of the trial court in granting the injunction. And third, the sound exercise of the trial court in submitting jury question number 8. With regard to the statutory interpretation from what I heard of the petitioner's argument, there. Interpretation, their proposed interpretation has softened from section 5 of the brief, which basically said that the date of operation should control when a statute of repose began, and pretty much omitted that portion of the statute that talks about conditions and circumstances changing.
I was never sure that was the position, even though you were afraid it wasn't your voice. But let me ask you about, be sure I understand your position. You say that this statute never applies bar nuisance action if the conditions substantially change after the agricultural operation.
Yes.
It just doesn't apply at all.
That's how it's written. Yeah. And it is, I think, commented that it
doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. As long as it's not a nuisance on the first day, then it's grandfathered in no matter what happens. But if it gets to be a nuisance later, it doesn't. Nothing happens. Just nothing.
I would not take credit for authorship of that statute, Your Honor, but that's how it is, exactly how it's written. And, of course, the two-year statute of limitations still applies. The general two-year statute would apply.
That wouldn't say an existing operation when somebody would be. This saves that, I take it.
Right.
If you move in where there's an operation ongoing, that has not substantially changed since it started, and it's no question it's a nuisance, that's too bad.
That's what this statute was designed to protect. Existing agricultural operations that have been going on for some time, and someone moves in next to it, came to the nuisance. And that's the legitimate purpose of this statute. It is not designed, I don't think, to cover the situation where a feedlot is placed, built next to an existing residence. And that's really what happened in this case, despite what the petitioner claimed at trial.
Do you agree at this point that the Court of Appeals' undisputed date for commencement of operations is March 19, 1997, whatever it is?
No, sir, I don't think we do. And the reason is there was ongoing construction on that feedlot after March 19, 1997. The most expensive part of the feedlot, which was the lagoon that caught all the wastewater over next to the Brandenburger's house, wasn't even built until a year after the lawsuit was filed. Water lines were not put in the pens up next to Brandenburger's house until within a year of the time that the suit was filed.
there was a progressive building of this feedlot. And in the court of appeals.
But even if it were that date, you still think you win because the operation substantially changed after that date?
Yes, sir. The facts, the conditions and circumstances, to use the statutory language, that constitute the basis of the nuisance did not appear until late August of 1997. And intermittently, the Brandenburgers began to notice a smell after a rain. They started noticing flies on occasion within a year of the time they filed suit. It progressively got worse until there were hordes of flies that pestered them all the time. The smell was constant at times. And that all happened. The testimony in this case from expert witnesses is that it takes 6 months to a year for a feedlot to develop the manure pack necessary to sustain the colonies of flies that so plagued the respondents in this case. So if we look at this as a statute of repose, it certainly does cut off some very valuable rights before they ever accrue, and would work injustice to property rights of the neighbors to the feedlot.
Do you see any harm?
Why do you say this is a limitation statute as opposed to repose?
Because it has the proviso in there about the conditions and circumstances have to exist. If you read the statute according to its language, they would have to exist on the first day of operation. And because of that, there would be a cause of action on the date of operation. Otherwise, the statute doesn't apply according to its clear language.
Well, but if we adopt your reading the conditions that give rise to it are the effects of the nuisance that become apparent, then does it matter if we call it a statute of limitations or repose for your purposes here?
Makes no difference. The Court of Appeals is exactly right on that. It's immaterial as to the outcome of this case. Whether or not it's a statute of repose or a statute of limitations, we simply look at whether or not the conditions or circumstances constitute the basis of this action remains substantially unchanged since the established state of operation. Now, I'm going to get out of water here for just a second and go to a point about jury question number 8, because I think that will elucidate why this case sometimes appears a little bit convoluted. And the theory of defense at the trial of this case was in a state of flux, and it remains in a state of flux through the trial court, the Court of Appeals, and this court. It originally started out from pretrial, motion for summary judgment, depositions, and interrogatories, that the Hollybecks had adopted a theory of defense that said these Brandenburger plaintiffs and their predecessors in the title came to our nuisance. And obviously they wanted to have that sort of a theory because that's what this statute was designed to protect. Mr. Hollybeck testified that he operated his feedlot before the house was ever built. The house was built in 1989, and that was his testimony in deposition. That was a testimony in an affidavit for summary judgment. A week before trial, we had to exchange exhibits, and the respondents had a big blown-up USDA aerial photograph that showed it was taken in 1983, 3 years before the Hollybecks ever leased this place, and it showed the house, the Brandenburger house, on there. But that wasn't enough time for, and the Hollybecks had invested too much in this defense that they didn't completely change it. Therefore, at trial, they still maintained and testified the established date of operation was 1986. That there was no substantial change from 1986 until the date of trial. That feedlot had been run like it had always been run. That there was no change in it. and it was clear, unequivocal testimony, backed up by answers to interrogatories and pleadings. That was the consistent position that was taken in this. They did change the testimony about when the Brandenburger's house was built and said, well, we don't know when it was built at trial, but admitted that in all pretrial, they had said it was built after the feedlot was there. So that's the defense that the petitioner chose to present to the trial court. And the trial court submitted jury question number 8 by substituting in the statutory language established date of operation, the date December 31st, 1986, which comported with the testimony of the Hollybacks as to when their established date of operation was.
Let me ask you this. My understanding is that your position is that the conditions that form the basis of the nuisance is the flies, the mold, and that didn't really appear until August. Is that right?
That's right.
If that's the case, and there's evidence to support that, why does it matter when the operation began, whether it's 97 or 86? Why does that make any difference?
Only because of the statutory language. I think if the court looks at the open... We look at the open court's argument and go that direction, it doesn't matter.
But that depends upon how you define the basis of the nuisance. I mean, if we agree that the basis of the nuisance are the effects and not the sheep, if we were to say that it were the effects to avoid open court's problems, and there's evidence to support your position that those effects did not present themselves until August, why does the date of the operation matter? Or what would it in that situation?
I don't think it does. And then I agree, we've got one section that says that there's no evidence of any nuisance before August of 1997, and therefore they wouldn't be entitled to a jury question on their permanent defense anyway. Because as a matter of law, conditions and circumstances arose within a year of time suit was filed, and after the established date of operation.
Part of your argument that the court should not find error in the submission of this question because it was invited?
I don't think there is error because of the Hollybacks. Well, I believe it is invited, but I don't believe it's even error because that's their judicial admission, and we've cited the cases that, you know, normally testimonial declaration is a quasi-judicial admission, but in this particular case, it meets all five of the written cases of what it says about all five of the factors that would cause it to be a binding judicial admission. And when that judicial admission is made, of course, I think it cannot be said to have abused his discretion in believing their testimony and submitting their own defensive theory according to their own testimony.
Coming to the injunction.
Yes, sir.
Looks pretty broad.
We do not agree that that's a broad injunction or an injunction that is too onerous.
Well, it says, for example, disposing of dead animals. So if your pet dog died, you just have to bury across the road. It seems a little broad.
The Brandenburgers have a lot of land. They've got land across.
Well, but maybe they do.
The Hollybacks, excuse me.
Yeah.
And as Justice Howard recognized in his opinion of the Court of Appeals, their actions in this case appear willful. I mean, locating a feedlot 135 feet from their neighbor's bedroom window is a little bit extreme. When people behave like this, I think it puts a red light on the trial court's mind. We've got to have an injunction that cannot be circumvented. And, of course, this court's writings go way back. The San Antonio Bar Association versus Guardian Title case, come to mind as an example of this court saying that the trial court should fashion an injunction that will prevent the harm and prevent circumvention of the harm.
So are you saying there's a punitive aspect to this injunction?
I do not think so. I think that it anticipates what could go wrong, how the injunction should be circumvented, and it enjoins those actions. And let's just talk about what it enjoins for a little bit, and talk about the evidence that supports each element of the injunction. Disposing of dead animals. If there was evidence that the Hollybecks put a dead pit right up next to the Granny Burger's pit.
Well, that's the problem that I have. It doesn't say maintaining a dead pit or maintaining a dead pit close to the boundary. It just says disposing of dead animals.
Yeah. Well,
I take it this is rural property, so I assume you might shoot a skunk out there or something. Not just flying around. But it says you can't do that.
The evidence was that the Hollybecks had a place that after Superfile they began to dispose of dead animals. It was not on the land that adjoined the Brandenburg.
But if they wanted to partition this property and sell it, this injunction would not let the new owner do anything.
That's true.
You couldn't keep a horse. If your horse died, you couldn't burn its carcass. Or if a milk cow died,
you couldn't feed
the horse out of the feed bucket.
I disagree on feeding the horse out of the feed bucket. The way that it says it, you can't feed them except for what the land can support and produce and supplement feed. And this is.
If you go to the feed store by Purina Horse Chow, you can't come out there and put them on.
Well, no, it says that they're prohibited from feeding any feed within 1,750 feet of existing land.
Right. Which gives them plenty of room on the other part of this land to feed animals.
On this L-shaped track.
Right.
How far is... I haven't seen the map.
Well, it probably runs half to two-thirds of the distance from the Brandenburger house, but there's plenty of area down on the other parts of the land to put out to be the way it's situated. You can look at the aerial maps and evidence that they contain hay and feed past that 750 foot boundary.
My concern about that, just the posture of the case, is they were doing a lot of this in 20 acres. And I couldn't tell whether they added more sheep in the 10 acres or whether they just took the sheep they had on 20 acres and put them in the 10 acres. So it's hard for me to tell. But it looked like this injunction, I mean, the argument is that the injunction takes that whole 20 acres or whatever it is and puts it outside the scope of running what they were running before they reduced it to 10 acres. Am I incorrect about that?
No, sir. I think you're correct about that. Here's the problem. They cite a case, Rogers case, that talks about a building where there's a gambling establishment on the first floor and a trial court entered an injunction saying no gambling in the building, and they applied to the second floor. They say all the trial court had the discretion to do was to deal with this 10-acre tract, and we propose that cannot be in the law. The Rogers case, the Eastland Court of Appeals case, the leasehold in the second floor and the first floor were different. Leasehold interests owned by different people. There was no evidence of gambling or that gambling could be handled on the second floor. We don't think it's in point. And what about the situation? What if they had 1 acre feedlot that was in the corner closest to the Ratty Burger house? Are we to say that we've got to have a new trial, that all the court can do is say you can't put a feedlot on that 1 acre. So the Hollybecks move it over 1 acre, 210 feet if it's a square acre, and put a feedlot on that, and we have to have another trial to keep them off of that acre, and they keep progressively going down the fence line until finally it gets far enough away.
But if the complaint is, it seems to me, had they not reduced the 20 acres down to 10 acres, we wouldn't be here, because it seems the statute would essentially apply, because the basis of the nuisance didn't occur until it was reduced from 20 to 10. So shouldn't the extent of the trial court's injunction be simply to undo the 10 and put them back on the 20.
That was right, thanks. And I think more understanding of the defense on Holly Beck's had a trial, and there were several problems with it. One, it just didn't comport with the facts. But 20 acres, it's not hotly disputed as to whether it was a feedlot at all or a trial. The pictures in evidence are going to show that before 1996, it was a brushy trap. The owners and the occupants of the house, going back several occupants, testified that they never saw any sheep. They never experienced any nuisance. They never had any flies while that 20-acre trap was there. The fence was falling down, and they drove trucks over to work on telephone lines, and it wasn't a feedlot, as I can see, a trap.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, even if we concede, which we do not, all of the respondents' arguments regarding the right to farm act in question 8, the injunction in this case is still an abuse of discretion. I'd like to illustrate that by focusing on a couple of the cases that respondents cite. You've heard San Antonio Bar Association versus Guardian Abstract cited to you earlier this morning. However, the case also has this language, which I think is instructive. And obviously, too, the injunction decree cannot prejudge new situations which were not before the court in the first instance. This injunction decree clearly does just that. It does not only prohibit the feeding of sheep in that 10-acre enclosure, it prohibits the feeding of any animal. If the Hollybecks, for example, decided that they would use those 10 acres and the 15 or 20 pens therein to begin stabling one horse per pen, they can't do that under the terms of this injunction, whether it imposes a nuisance on their neighbors or not. So what should the injunction look like? Well, I would submit to you that it ought to look like the injunction in another case cited by the respondents, Lamb versus Kinslow. That was a cotton gin case, where a gin constructed a pipe 950 feet in length that terminated 450 feet from the plaintiff's house. The gin blew the cotton burrs, the trash, to the end of that pipe and burned them there. There was evidence that that was a nuisance. The jury found that there was a nuisance, and the court awarded an injunction. As here, the jury awarded little or no monetary damages.
But you agree that this court can modify the injunction. We can point out what's wrong with it and amend it, but we can't ourselves modify it.
That's correct. And I think there are some instances where this court in the last few years, I believe there's the UT Med School versus Tron case where this court did modify an injunction. But this injunction is such a mess that even if you could modify it, I would argue that you shouldn't. And what did the injunction in the Kinslow case enjoin? The court points out the defendant was not restrained from ginning cotton. It did not put the defendant out of the ginning business. He wasn't even restrained from burning those burrs, that trash. He was only prohibited from burning burrs at a place and in a manner which will injure the plant. So what the trial court should have done was consider injunctions like that one and fashioning this one. The trial court clearly should have considered cases like the Supreme Court's opinion in the Story case. It should have considered cases like the Garland Grainclad case, which is incredibly factually similar to this one. In both instances, you had a going feedlot in a rural area. The feedlots were both 10 acres in size. They were both on the corners of the tract. The Garland Grain case had a 5,000-head cattle feedlot. We're talking about a feedlot with a maximum capacity of 5,500 head. The jury found a nuisance in both cases. It was a lawful business in both cases. And in both cases, the residence was there before the feedlot. In the Garland Grain case, all 41 landowner plaintiffs were there before the feedlot. The court in Garland Grain dissolved the trial court's injunction, which was not nearly as broad as this one, because questions of health were not involved. It was a rural area, and there was an easily ascertainable legal remedy. The court, in so doing, relied on this court's 1909 statement that it does not require argument or authority to say that damages to real estate can be easily compensated for in money. And that's
if the nuisance is ongoing, it will not.
Actually, there have been holdings, there are holdings, that a recurring nuisance can be compensated for in money at one time. Meat Producers versus McFarland, which is found at 476 Southwest 2nd 406, is just such a case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause. We'll take another brief recess.
All right.